My name is Tom Droege, and this is my wife, Esther. And we're going to be, I'm assuming primary responsibility for what we're going to do this week, but Esther's going to help out a lot in what I do, and so we're looking at this as a team effort. I want to tell you a little bit about my background and have Esther do the same. So you've got a feel for who we are and what we bring to what we want to do this week. We're going to be talking together about spirituality and health and how the two interconnect. And next week we're going to be focusing on how that affects the church's ministry and what the church's ministry ought to be in the light of the connections between spirituality and health. And some of that is likely to come into our conversations this week as well. But for this week, we're focusing mostly on what it means to be healthy, what our healthcare system does or doesn't do to facilitate that, and the kind of responsibility that we can assume for our own health as Christians, particularly spiritual health. I've been interested in the relationship between religion and medicine for many, many years, all the way back to the beginning of the time that I was teaching at Valparaiso University in Northwest Indiana. Fairly soon after I came there, I was asked to serve as the study director for a medical mission conference of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod that was to be held in South India.
That's okay, I'm just going to sit beside you.
And we preceded that by a whole year-long study program of the participants in that conference. It were mostly medical missionaries, which included nurses who were doing overseas medical work and missionaries that were engaged in the work of the church overseas. And it was a conference that was designed to ask what is the future of the work of the church in healthcare, particularly in overseas missions where developing countries were beginning to assume the responsibility for health care that prior to that only the church had provided. And that got me very interested, and I've stayed interested ever since, on how the world of medicine and the world of the church interconnect. You're probably all aware that that in the long tradition that goes all the way back practically to the beginning of the church, there's been a very sharp division where medicine and the world of medicine has assumed the responsibility for the care of the body, and the church has had the responsibility for the care of the soul, and they're like two different territories, two different worlds. And those two worlds lived in pretty good harmony as long as each respected the other's turf. And you only had disputes at times like if somebody refused medical treatment for religious reasons, like a Jehovah's Witness who didn't want a blood transfusion. And then suddenly you were on the turf of medicine, which cares for the body, and then you'd have conflict. Or a Christian Scientist who won't allow their child to be treated by medicine. That's another turf battle that occurs. But as long as medicine stayed with the body and the church stayed with the soul, that was not much of a problem. Well, I got very interested in that, and I have been ever since. A lot of my teaching was in that area. I taught a course for nurses on spiritual needs and health care to attune them to how in their work as nurses and as a lot of pre-med students who were going into medicine, how they, in terms, just in their profession, could be paying attention to the spiritual dimension of the people that they cared for. And then in the last few years, I've become tremendously interested in all of the mind-body studies that have been going on that show the connections between the mind and the body, in how the immune system works, in the effects of stress on the body, in what it means if you live isolated lives in terms of morbidity and mortality statistics, all kinds of studies like that going on, to show that the body is not separate from the mind or the spirit of a person, and that we need to pay attention to the connections between two of those. And we'll be talking a lot about that in the course of the week. I'll say just one last word about what I'm doing now. I've moved to Atlanta, Georgia, just been there about 2 months, exploring what I could do in the area of church and health, which is really where my heart lies and where my gifts lie. And just a week ago, got an assignment with the Task Force for Child Survival and Development, which is connected to the Carter Center in Atlanta. The Task Force for Child Survival is sponsored by WHO, UNICEF, the United Nations Development Bank, and the Rockefeller Foundation. And their assignment, they're just about 6 years old, 7 years old, was to help coordinate all these agencies in a worldwide effort to immunize every child throughout the world. We take that for granted in this country. It's not taken for granted in the rest of the world. And they've made dramatic progress in just 6 years. Just 6 years ago, there were only 20% of the world's children who were immunized from all of the dread diseases that can be protected by vaccinations. As of now, 80% of the world's children are immunized. It's just a dramatic success story when you have the political will and can find the resources to do that. And now there is the possibility of the global eradication of polio throughout the world. Smallpox is the only infectious disease that's been wiped off the face of the earth. You do not need to inoculate a child or vaccinate a child against smallpox because it's only transmitted through humans. And once you've eliminated it, it's gone. Now, the same thing is true of polio. If you can eliminate the wild polio vaccine virus, you can eliminate polio. And so I've been asked to write up a proposal for that, working with the Rotary International, who had a lot of involvement in this already, to try to raise the resources, particularly among the churches and the synagogues in this country, for a campaign to eradicate polio by the year 2000. And if this is successful, you'll hear a lot more about that within the 6 months from now. And I hope to have conversations with you, some of you, about that, and because it's just in the idea stage, and I'm very interested in getting ideas from people through conversations up here. I've talked more about that than I really intended to as an introduction. But Esther, say a little bit about yourself.
I'm Esther Droege, and I plan to bring the practical end of all this into our conversation. I've been in nursing ever since I graduated from Lutheran Hospital in St. Louis. Along the way, I've worked in hospitals, I've worked in extended care facilities. I also got a master's in nursing, after which time I did some teaching at Valparaiso University. And then in the mid-80s, I decided I wanted to take a different turn in my career, and I went to law school. I graduated from law school in 1988, planning to somehow or other bring my nursing medical background into the legal community, at which time then I moved to Atlanta, where with the economic situation the way it is and having no connections. I was not able to get a job in a law firm or do exactly what I had intended, but I am working as a medical coordinator for a nationwide insurance company, and I've been amazed how much of my legal knowledge that I actually do need as I work with the medical reviews that I do for the insurance company. And that is primarily my background.
Okay. Our topic for today is whole person health and how spirituality, particularly the spiritual dimension of whole person health. Whole person health, some people talk about holistic health care, is something that everybody agrees with. There's no bone of contention about this in medicine or among people who are concerned about different dimensions of health. Everybody says we need to treat the whole person and get away from our narrow focus just on one aspect of this. And that's going to be the subject this morning. This has as much to do with experience as it does with thinking, with your heads about this. And so I want to start this morning with an exercise. I call it a whole person exercise to put you in touch with this in terms of your experience. And then we'll engage your minds to think about this more as we proceed in the course of the day. So I invite you, during the course of this exercise, it'll just be a few minutes, to either close your eyes or keep them focused on one particular place in the room so that you won't be distracted by me or by anything that you see around the room, so that you can look inside for just a few moments for the purpose of this exercise. So I urge you to either close your eyes or keep them focused in one place of the room so that you can spend a few moments looking into the center of yourself. We spend almost our entire waking day looking outside, being engaged with what is going on outside of us. We spend precious little time looking inward to our own inner experience. Pay attention to your breathing. Breathing in and out. The most natural rhythm of your body, which we take for granted all of the time, but rarely pay attention to. And get in touch with your body. Perhaps some place of tension within it, some discomfort somewhere within your body, or perhaps just the comfortableness of being able to sit down without any great stress about what you need to be doing for the rest of the day and feeling relaxed. Be aware of your body, because your body is you. Now go inside yourself and make a room for yourself inside. Imagine a room that is a place for you and you alone to be with yourself. Make the room as comfortable as possible and furnish it in any way that you wish. You don't have to please anybody but yourself. You may want to put a picture window at one end of the room through which you can observe one of the Cascade Mountains or a mountain lake. This is a place that you can come away from the noise and busyness of life and be with yourself and your own thoughts and experiences. A place to which you can return anytime that you desire. Now, with your eyes still closed, reach out your hand to the person on either side of you. And as you do so, feel the energy which flows through the room, the sense of community that we are immediately aware of when we feel the touch that connects us with another person. Be aware of the special kind of fellowship which brings us together here at Holden as a community. The common concern that we share for basic human values and for nurturing the human spirit and for worshiping and praising God in the midst of nature. Feel the solidity of the chair which is holding your weight. A chair which in turn is supported by the floor of this building and Mother Earth beneath it. Feel your solidarity with all those that are part of the ecosystem, the animals, the plants coming to life in the spring, the fish, the birds, all of us dependent on air and water and nutrients from a delicately balanced order of nature. And finally, let your human spirit feel its closeness to that which is the source and ground of all that is. Feel the power, the creativity, the love, and the peace which comes to you from beyond yourself. Feel the link between your human spirit and the Spirit of God. And let the Spirit of God surround you and fill you with goodness and power and peace. And then as you feel ready, return to this place, this room, and open your eyes and reorient yourself to these surroundings. You can continue holding hands if you want. You know. That's to give you an experience of the different dimensions of who you are as a person, a body, a person who has an inner being, an inner experience, a person who is connected to others and who is nothing apart from relationships. A person who is linked to every aspect of the whole created order, and a person who is related to God in the deepest dimension of our being. That's what it means to be a whole person. And that's more to do with experience than it does with thinking about things. Now, our healthcare system in this country is not designed well for whole person health care. And I think that when history is written, the 20th century will become known as the great century for science and medicine, what science and technology has been able to do to revamp health care. And I think that it will be remembered with great appreciation. We already appreciate it immensely. If you had been born at the turn of the century, your life expectancy would be 50 years. That would mean most of us in this room would not be here at this time. And it's been expanded because of the control of infant mortality, because of the magic bullets of the drugs like penicillin, and sulfa, which controls infectious diseases, And the other great modern advances in healthcare that enable us to enjoy the kind of health that we do. But it has been focused almost exclusively on what I would call disease care rather than health care. There is a map, a health map. I'm hoping that all of you will be able to see this, that was done by Robert Lamborn, who was, you need to see through me here. Let me get over. Well, when I get to the map, I'll just move this over.
Is it focused the best you can get?
I'm afraid it is.
Can't focus.
The other overheads I do, I think, will be clearer than this. I'll explain it as we go. Robert Lamborn was a physician, a psychiatrist, and also trained as an Episcopal priest, and so he was concerned about the relationship of religion and medicine. And he drew this map to describe what he saw going on in what I'm calling a disease care system. This line here, a vertical line, describes the extensiveness of the context in which healthcare is done. And it starts in a very narrow focus at the bottom end of this. This is micro. It means that part of medicine which focuses on microorganisms that you try to isolate, for example, when you're discerning what a particular disease is. As you go up, you move toward a broader context. Body organs would be a specialist, a thoracic surgeon, or a heart surgeon, or somebody who focuses on a specialty in the area of medicine. Then individual and family would be more the family doctor, family health care, the kind of person that you would go to when you first got sick. If you move beyond here to the neighborhood, then you're more concerned about what, in the broader context of people living together, causes illness. Some of the public health things that have been done in this country and throughout the world to control diseases like cholera were done by paying attention to what happens in the broader network of people living together. I've just been reading a book on disease and history in which the person who first discovered that cholera was passed through polluted water found out that all the people in a particular region of London got sick who were using the same pump. And so then was able to see what the pattern was. In terms of that's a focus on the neighbor. Go up ecological, and then you become concerned about the quality of our air and the quality of our water and what we're doing to our environment and the potential of destroying our health by not paying attention sufficiently to the environment, to the most broadest context, which would be the cosmic one. And here, you would be concerned primarily, I think, about how God is involved in what is going on. Now, that's the extensiveness of the context. This horizontal line is the concept of healing, and what Lamborn said is that also moves from the very narrow to the much broader. And on the very narrow end is disease eradication by mechanistic manipulation. And when science and scientific medicine at its best does that, by the use of science and technology, it focuses on the disease and the eradication of the disease. And that's a very narrow concept of what disease and health is all about. When you can't do that, you can at least do disease management, which is what happens with chronic illness, for example, where there's no cure possible, but you can manage with proper medication and so forth. to providing care even when cure is not possible. And here the physician recedes in the background and the nurse emerges as the primary figure, because nursing has always been associated with the kind of care that is provided even when cure is not possible. But you can make that concept even broader when you talk about growing through illness and say that a person can be very ill and actually grow through the process of dealing with the illness. But obviously here your concept of disease and what it means to be well is shifting beyond a bodily one, which includes how you cope and what your spirit is. Strengthening strengths, finding the center of oneself, a much broader concept of healing, until the one at this end is dying that others may live. And that, of course, the supreme example would be Jesus Christ. We, within the Christian tradition, would say that the cross is the most significant healing event in all of history. How can you say that when what is happening is that the body of a man is disintegrating? It's because we think in very broad terms about what healing is all about, and say that's healing, what is happening when Christ gives himself for the whole world. So the point of all this is that this arrow toward the narrow end of the context of healing and the concept of healing is the direction that shows you what the value system of medical treatment is. It's toward the very narrow end of both the context and the concept of healing. And if you move toward a holistic health, you're moving toward a much broader understanding of what health is and what is needed in order to restore persons to the fullness of health. So that's one way of looking at the disease care system of modern medicine. Now let me give you another diagram that gets at it just a little bit differently. This is the distribution of sickness and services. I get this from Granger Westberg, who is a pioneer of whole person health care, and more recently of parish nurse practices that are springing up all over the country. And what Granger suggested is that you can see through this kind of diagram where the resources are and where the sick people are. And what he suggested was that that you have three acts of illness. Act one is this line over, and he said that's when you're just a little bit sick. That's when somebody looks at you and says, gee, you're not looking too well. Are you feeling all right? Most likely to come from a spouse, maybe a good friend. Or when you begin to feel a little something that's not quite right, not enough to take you to the doctor, but maybe you've been too stressed out and you recognize that. And if you take corrective measures, you can move back, you can reverse this and eliminate the problem. 60% of sick people are in this place, 1% of the physicians. In other words, medicine doesn't pay much attention at this point. This line here, the diagonal, broken line, is where the physicians and the money of medicine are. These lines here show where the people are who are sick. That's the difference. Now in Act 2, you're sick enough so that you figure you better get some help. It's during this act when you're likely to go to see your physician and check out what's going on. And perhaps with proper medication, some other prescription, you can reverse that and move back toward health again. 30% of the sick people here, 29% of the physicians. In other words, it's fairly evenly balanced. But Act 3, when you're really sick, and this is when you reach the crisis stage, And you have to have the sophisticated kind of treatment that you find in modern medical hospitals. Here, only 10% of the sick people, but 70% of the physicians and the resources in terms of costs are located. In other words, our disease care health system is heavily weighted toward the end of care for people who are dramatically ill and need very sophisticated treatment in order to reverse it. Very little in terms of what we would call primary health care. That is a description of what the system is. I want to take a moment just to get your reactions to that. Do you find that to be true? Esther, you worked in the world of medicine for a long time. You want to start us off?
Okay. I want to go, I see myself as participating in Act One. As I mentioned earlier, I work with Nationwide Insurance Company. And my primary responsibilities at the insurance company are to review medical records. So basically, I'm there to handle papers. But I found it very interesting, I've been there only since January, that people come to me with their problems. I've talked to people, several men that have discussed their heart problems with me. I talked to somebody the other day, he was bitten by some fire ants. What should he do with his fire ants? Bites, how should he treat them? I've talked to some people about their emotional problems. I've talked to some of the women about menstrual difficulties. So here we are with people. I think this is normal. I think probably everybody in this room at some time or another has a problem that's not major that they want some help or advice on. And where do they go? I've called a number of clinics in Atlanta. I simply want a little bit of information. Yes, we'll give you that information, but first you have to come in and see the doctor. Well, that's not what I wanted. I just wanted some information. I just wanted just a little bit of encouragement or direction or that kind of thing. So there are a lot of people, I think, fall into this category that really have nowhere to go, and that's why I'm finding myself giving out advice at the office, which is really, as I say, not my job. Like Freddie Prinze used to say, that's not my job. But I appreciate the people coming to see me because I do think I do have the information generally that they need, and if I don't have the information, I usually know where to go and get it. I also believe that this is very true, that 70% of the physicians are out there doing the big things. I mean, they're not going to get recognition or anything like that by handing out the kind of advice I'm talking about that is really needed. I also want to talk a little bit about the Oregon experience. How many of you are from Oregon? Now, you might be able to help me on this, but in Oregon, I think they're trying to reverse the triangle. They're trying to get it so that most of the people that need it will have some kind of medical care available. They have given a number to 700 and some conditions. And this has been done with a committee with an MD heading it up. And my understanding is that this looks like a really good plan to me as a member of the medical community. So that if you are up through 500 and something, that if you have one of those 500 conditions, you're going to get help. And those are the majority of the people fall into 1 to 500. But Oregon is having a terrible time dealing with this. In fact, the latest, if I'm correct, you from Oregon, they just turned it down, didn't they?
That's what I said. The government did, though. They turned it down.
Which government?
The guards.
The federal government.
No, the federal government did it. Yeah. Yeah, the federal government turned it down, not Oregon.
No.
Right.
We're still struggling with it, and we're going to, people of Oregon quite independent, as you all know, and we're going to work with it. But,
so Oregon has passed it, but Uncle Sam has decided this is not too good.
Well, it requires a waiver.
Yeah.
And the waiver requires the
federal government to allow us to redistribute the money in a fashion which is different from what Title 19 and other Social Security projects has mandated. And what we, the Oregon people want to do is redistribute that money in a fashion consistent with its plan. The plan says we have so much money, we have rated the cost effectiveness of these 854 conditions, and we can tell how much it will cost to treat those. And we will take the most cost efficient ones and we'll treat all those until we run out of money. And when we get to the things that cost a lot of money and we don't have very much left, we won't fund those. So saving the 20-ounce baby is born prematurely, costs $500,000. They won't do that. They will treat 1,000 kids who have whooping cough.
Let me focus this more in terms of what we understand brings illness to ourselves. Let me put it this way. What makes people sick, do you think? What are some of the things that come to your mind?
Virus.
Virus? Write those down.
Migraine. Sure.
Okay.
Stress.
Injuries. Or is that?
No, injuries.
Pushing the healthcare system.
Yeah, sure does.
Bad diet.
Okay.
Teeth,
what else?
Problem, you know.
What?
Teeth.
Okay.
I think I missed a couple of right at the beginning. So which?
Injuries.
Accidents. Organ disorder.
Well, that's the evidence of the sickness. I'm asking, what is it that makes people sick?
Well, aren't they telling us genetics?
Genetics. Yeah.
Genetics.
Put genetics down. Tobacco? Good. Tobacco is the number one cause of illness that could be prevented. Anything else?
Drugs.
And that covers a wide range of things, you know.
Like coffee.
Like coffee. Too much of it. Anything else? Okay, now how many...
Heat, exposure.
Exposure.
Well, mental problems.
What kinds of things are you thinking about in mental problems?
Worry.
Okay. Depression would be another one, because there's lots of evidence for how depression causes illness. Now, for how many of those things would you go to a physician? Which
virus.
Ones? Virus, you would.
Accident.
Injury. Yeah, that's right.
Depression if it's bad enough.
Well, certain genetic things.
Certain genetic things you would. Though if you go to a doctor for depression, what's going to happen?
You're going to get more drugs.
You're going to get more drugs.
Yeah.
It's going to be treated by alleviating what the symptoms are that are there to do it. What's that?
Most of the time.
Most of the time.
I think for heat or exposure, you might go to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Those are names.
VA.
Okay. The point of this is that there are lots of things for which we need to go to a doctor, and none of us would want to do without it. And it's important enough that we're willing to fight for health care for everybody and not just for ourselves, which is one of the big political issues in this election. But it's not enough. That's the real point I want to make. Let me show you, put on another. This is the treatment model that would be characteristic of the medical care that we all want and need. And it's based on the assumption that health is understood as the absence of symptoms of illness. In other words, the neutral point. If you don't have any symptoms that would say, I need to go to a doctor, then you're healthy. And symptoms is the first indication of the problem and that you would go and hopefully get the kind of treatment that will reverse this and get you back to the neutral point. But it can, the symptoms can develop into a disease for which you need more sophisticated kind of treatment in order to reverse the process and get you back to the neutral point. But if the disease progresses to a state of disintegration, it will inevitably lead to premature death. Part of the assumption of this particular diagram is that premature death can be reversed. It's preventable. And there are the statistics that come out of Communicable Center for Disease Control say that 70% of lifestyle diseases today can be reversed and are preventable. But not only through the treatment model. The other dimension of this is the wellness model, which says that health is to be understood as more than the absence of symptoms, but by health promotion and health prevention, you can be in a position for the fullness of health that we need to have a different term for than just health. Awareness of what the consequences of smoking are, or a bad diet, or lack of exercise. And that takes education to develop the awareness in order to know that. But education is never enough. Anybody who smokes knows what the effects of smoking are on disease. And so just knowing is not enough in order to make a difference. There needs to be some attention to growth in order to develop the incentive to take responsibility for your health in a way that you haven't before. And by assuming responsibility in terms of health promotion and prevention, many of these diseases that develop are preventable and postponable. Now, the question that I want to raise for you to think about and talk about a little bit is how many of you have been to your doctor where they paid much attention to this? What's your experience been?
They'll just give you a different pill.
Give you a different pill?
Yeah.
Not exactly. Not all the time. I had a very serious operation in 1967, and I remember the doctor came in, the surgeon afterward, and he asked me if I could wiggle my toes. It was a spine and I could wiggle one just a wee bit. And I remember his statement, he said, now, if you want to walk bad enough, you'll walk.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't want to, you'll never walk.
Yeah.
So that was paying attention to
plus
something more than pills, I would say.
He was trying to make you motivated to cure yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it was on the right side, I would say.
Yeah.
But what else did he say?
Pardon?
Is that all? Is that all he said?
Well, I was so weak then, we didn't talk much.
Did he not tell you how to go about walking, or?
Yeah, what? And afterward he had to have therapy and all that sort of thing, huh? And the last word before I went back to Africa is, how much can I walk? And he says, just as much as you can. You know, I mean, he told me to go for it. Huh? He's climb as many mountains as you can. I've never been very good at climbing mountains, but I mean, he gave me the go sign.
It's still on this side, however, to the extent that he wanted to get back to the point where you were before.
Exactly.
And the difference would be of somebody who would say you ought to need to go out and hike, not because you've had a problem, but because you want to prevent a problem in the future.
Mm-hmm. I think a yeah. good example, I mean, for my point of view, incarceration in prison camp, we were forced because of our situation to go to the right. Mm-hmm. Very definite.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
We had very low. So a lot of it's what they call biofeedback.
Yeah.
And we joked about it, the old vitamin stick of the guards out on the farm. You got healthy in a hurry.
Mm-hmm. And unless you found...
That's an honest truth to that.
Right. Unless you found the resources within yourself.
Because those of us who survived, everyone said that. You might say the best of the fittest.
Yeah. Yeah, that's supported, I think, also by reports of the survivors of the death camps. Viktor Frankl, among others, of saying that the people who survive are the people who had a reason to live and some sense of purpose and who could assume responsibility for themselves.
And life back now, that life maintained the same as other person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had some symptoms that were stress caused, and the doctor not only treated the symptoms but asked me, now, how are you spending your time? How many hours a week are you working? What are you doing for recreation? Which I think was definitely going
in
that direction.
Yeah.
And partly as a result of that conversation, I ended up changing to a job that was less stressful.
Good. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good example, I think, of what healthcare really needs to be.
I think there's a lot more education being given now than there used to be. For instance, before surgeries or cardiac operations or that sort of thing, they're very careful to tell you exactly what can happen. Mm-hmm. And I think probably a lot of it is because they're so gloom and afraid they're going to be sued.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably one of the things that has caused this additional information and education.
Yeah, I think that's right. There certainly is more information provided, but it still belongs on this side in terms of treatment rather than what can be done toward prevention and promotion. Carl?
Well, I think there's something else that happened. Probably it happened in dentistry sooner. Excuse me. We used to go to the dentist when a tooth hurt. But we got in the place, see your dentist twice a year, and now the idea of see your physician once a year, whether you're hurting or not. And I think in that situation, they're much more likely to start getting into the wellness model.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
But if you look at it from the standpoint of the possibility of AIDS and all these venereal diseases, there's a lot of education, and that's preventable.
Oh, yes, it is.
Radio, TV.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a whole wellness movement that is pushing the education and the awareness and assuming responsibility for your own health care. Yes?
But do the insurance companies pay for those visits if they don't have a little number to put on there? If you just go in there to say, how can I get in touch with myself so that I'm feeling better, I don't think the insurance companies are going to reimburse you for going to the doctor if you're just going because you want to find out about them. You know what I'm saying?
That's right. Many insurance companies will not pay for a checkup, an annual checkup,
right.
which seems to me really stupid policy, self-defeating kind of policy.
Well,
And that fits within the system. Roman?
What's the AMA's position regarding holistic medicine?
It is very guarded. It has reacted very strongly against a holistic medicine that is in rebellion against the traditional mode of medicine. It started out in the West Coast, but it spread. There are physicians who use yoga, who use almost any kind of method for healing that has been designed by humanity. And the AMA looks at this with great suspicion. Though if you press the concern about dealing with the whole person, I don't know of anybody within the AMA who would question that. What they're suspicious about is the far out kind of thing that's being done. I want to introduce one other note into this before our time runs out, because it leads into what I want to for us to be thinking about tomorrow and beyond. This is a model of spiritual well-being that I got from a person called Brian, whose name is Brian Seward. And what it's trying to get at is the spiritual dimension of a person that affects health. And the assumption behind it, which I think is valid, is that everybody is spiritual, because we all have a human spirit. We all have spiritual needs. To be human is to have spiritual needs. Those needs are met in different ways by people, and most of us turn to our faith as the way in which our spiritual needs are met most deeply. But what I want to focus on initially is the broad concept of spirituality and what it means to have spiritual needs. This diagram divides this into three parts, and this one is internal and external relationships. Think of this as domestic policy and foreign policy. The domestic policy is how you relate to yourself, how much you are in touch with your own body and your own inner experience and your own inner world. If you have indications of too much stress, what do? Just shut that out? Or are you able to listen carefully to what is going on within yourself? And your experiences about that have to do with self-esteem and self-awareness. That's what this refers to in terms of spiritual health. The external relationships or the foreign policy has to do with how you relate to other people, your connectedness to the people who are around you. How strong is your support system? How much are you living an isolated life? And all kinds of studies are indicating that your connectedness to other people has a lot to do with the level of your health, your physical health. And I'll be talking more about that now. But that's part of spirituality, your relationship to yourself inside and your relationship to others on the outside. Another piece of this is the personal value system that you have. What you value most. And if what you value most is making money and being successful, and you organize your life around that, and don't pay much attention to your experience with yourself or your relationship to other people, That has all kinds of consequences to it in terms of stress and other sorts of things. If you smoke a lot, and if you don't pay any attention to your diet, you don't get any exercise at all, those are values. You choose those kinds of things, maybe implicitly, not by giving much thought, but that's a value system. And unfortunately, it's often not until some kind of tragedy strikes, like a heart attack, and then people begin to say, hey, I've had my values all screwed up. I need to take another look at this and recognize what's really important to me is my family. But it takes some dramatic kind of incursion into life in order for people to be aware of that. Meaningful purpose in life. We were talking before about concentration camps and the kind of people who survived in concentration camps. Most of the evidence suggests it's people with a meaningful purpose. Doctors have known for a long time that it's a person with the will to live or the will to walk who's going to find the resources to do that. If you've given up and you don't see any reason to live, then it's all going to go downhill from that point on. Now, these, there could be other things that we could add to that, but these are dimensions of what it means to be a person who is a human spirit. The spiritual dimension of whole person health care, which is what I want to focus particular attention on. You get the needs satisfied or get this developed ways that are both horizontal and vertical. I mean, you can find a purpose in life that's focused around your job or something else. You find relationships with other people that furnish your need for connectedness. But at the deepest level in all of these is God. All of us would say that as Christians. Our deepest connectedness with ourself is our relationship to God. Our deepest meaning and purpose is associated around our faith and what that means. So spirituality can be, spiritual needs can be met in all kinds of ways. At the deepest level, they are met in relation to God. We have roadblocks to spiritual health and exercises that can promote spiritual health, which lead then to spiritual strength and spiritual health as indicated here. Well, our time is up for today. What I'd like you to think about a little bit, if you're coming back tomorrow, are what some of the roadblocks to spiritual health are in your own life as you see it in the lives of others, and what some of the exercises are that can lead to better spiritual health in the lives of people, and what some of the implications are of that for health in terms of bodily health, I'll indicate through some studies that I've done when we meet together tomorrow. And I invite you all to come back tomorrow for more conversation about this. Thank you.
Thank you.